February for a meeting? Let's have one. My name is Jeff, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. With one or more years of sobriety, we'll tell his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and their personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing.
With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight. This is the first time I think he's told a story. I would like to introduce you, Mike.
My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. This Friday date is May 22nd, 2011. So I guess what I'm supposed to do is talk about what happened, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll start at the beginning. I was born December 17th, 1975, Crawford Long Hospital. My dad was a Vietnam vet. He came back all messed up from the war. This all happened, I didn't see this happen as a child because my parents got divorced when I was real young, but he would beat on her and run through the house. He came up, you know, all messed up, alcoholic, and, you know, beat on her and think he was still in the war, run through the house and that kind of stuff. So she divorced him and found out about a year ago that he died, about 10 years ago. And I'm sure drinking had something to do with it, but I didn't really inquire into more, to be honest with you. Growing up, my mom was also an alcoholic, and she was a violent alcoholic like he was. So that's kind of what I remember my childhood first being like, was my mom was, would be in the house breaking stuff and fighting with family. And, you know, that's kind of the first memories I have as a child. And I was born with real bad asthma when I was a kid, and I was always in and out of the hospital early on. I was real sick and I was real small, and it seemed like at least once every school year up until I was about 12 years old, I was always in the hospital, you know, missing school. And, you know, it sounds cliche, but being sick and being small and not what I felt was a normal family life, you know, like a lot of what I thought everybody else had, you know, I don't really know what other people had, you know, but I felt different, you know, I didn't feel worthy, I guess. I felt less than. My first alcoholic behavior was shoplifting. I was real into stealing stuff. I liked the rush of it. No one taught me how to do it that I can remember. I just somehow realized I liked stealing stuff at the store, you know. And I got away, I didn't get away with it a lot, but I got let go a lot when I would get caught because I was so small and so little. I think when I was like 12, they thought I was like 9 or something, so they would just be like, all right, just get out of here, you know. But I kept doing that. I kind of bounced around family members and stuff. I lived mostly when I was first born, like in Kenwood Park, that area in Atlanta. And but I lived with my uncle and stuff in Gwinnett County, started school there. And then back to Atlanta later on. Besides like the stuff I saw with my mom and stuff like that going on, you know, the first kind of tragic whatever thing to happen, I was small and I was molested by my grandfather as a kid. And that didn't go on real long, but it went on for maybe a year or so. And I was about 10 years old, I told him, you know, that wasn't going to go on anymore. And it never did again. And then he passed away a few years later. And, you know, that wasn't something I really thought about all the time. It's just kind of something I shoved down in the basement, I guess, you know, never really dealt with. But even though I was small and saw this stuff, you know, going in my family life, and police always coming to the house a lot. Not every day, but, you know, it happened pretty frequently, or it seemed like it anyway. You know, I was still kind of a happy kid, at least at some point. I was like a class clown. I did pretty good in school, had friends, all this kind of stuff like that. And then when I turned about 13, going on 14, I moved to Douglasville with my mom at the time, with her boyfriend. And I don't know how it is now, but at that point, I was like 1989. Douglasville was a real small town back then. When I moved there, I was kind of like a new kid, so I was kind of picked on, you know, and made fun of and stuff like that. So that was like, I never really experienced that before. And so, and you know, being 13, starting to go through these changes and stuff, I just like totally started to change, where I became like an introvert. You know, I started to just seclude myself and isolate, and a lot of depression started, a lot of anger. You know, I used to fantasize, and it happens all the time now, but, you know, I used to fantasize about going to school and shooting people I didn't like and teachers I didn't like and all that kind of stuff. You know, I thought about that kind of stuff. I really did. And then about a year later, I got arrested for a similar kind of thing. I got in a fight with these two brothers lived down two houses down, and we got in some kind of fight about something. I don't even remember what it was about, to be honest with you. And they left and kept coming back, like throwing rocks at the window and stuff like that. And I'd run outside, and they'd run away. And so I finally, my mom's boyfriend was an Atlanta police officer, so there was guns in the house, you know. So I ran out there and shot the gun. And I thought for a long time, I just shot it in the air or in the ground. Really, now I don't really remember. That could be so, but honestly, I was just kind of like in a rage that I don't really remember what, if I was really trying to kill them, if I was just trying to scare them, I don't really know, to be honest. So I was arrested for aggravated assault and went to jail. Well, I went to YDC for a little bit, not real long. Then I went to court. They sent me to Georgia Regional for like a psych evaluation. And was finally released and went back to court a few times. And finally, they gave me like 2 years strict probation with a lot of community service and that kind of thing, you know, because I'd never really been arrested before. I'd been in trouble, but never really went to, you know, YDC or nothing. And I went back to school the next year, and like the story got so blown out of proportion, you know, that I'd shot a bunch of people and that I had a shootout with the cops, and, you know, I was living in the woods, and sounds good, but that's not really what happened. The first thing I ever got high on actually was an asthma inhaler, you know. I don't know how I figured this out. Someone told me. Another thing I really don't remember, I just realized if I just sat there and was like, with those asthma inhalers, you get like that 30-second rush or whatever. And I like that, you know. I like that feeling of being high, basically, you know. And I tried alcohol a little bit. I never been drunk, though. I take a few sips, you know, when I was 11, 12, 13 years old. And I'm like, oh, this is gross, man. I don't want to drink this, you know. But I still couldn't wait to feel, you know, that high from drinking. I was still very, very curious about getting drunk. I wanted to do it. I couldn't get past the taste at that point, I guess. And then the next thing basically was huffing, you know, when I was 14. Some guys introduced me to huffing gasoline. And I liked that at the time, I guess. But the first time I got drunk, it was my 16th birthday. I have a brother who's about 6 years older than me. And I got drunk on my 16th birthday. We was at a pool hall. We was out in the parking lot drinking and stuff. And what I remember about it, what I liked, was I didn't really feel like I was there. I felt like in a dream world or something. You know, I didn't like reality. You know, I liked feeling like I really wasn't there. So I started doing that as much as I possibly could, you know. And I was doing all right in school at that point. Once I started drinking, that was like 9th grade, 10th grade. So I started drinking. Grade started to slip, basically. You know, about a year later, I was smoking pot. Then about a year after that, I was doing acid. I finally dropped out of school. Unbeknownst to me, I took 8 hits of acid. Didn't realize that. So afterwards, you know, the guy told me like the next day, decided to drop out of high school. that point. Basically, did some construction jobs at that point, you know, different stuff there. I got involved with a girl when I was like 17, 18, and she was almost as bad as me, you know. We were not good for each other, basically. We were together for like 3 years. And she would get jobs at cash registers stealing, you know, money. And, you know, the biggest score I thought was when she got a job at the pharmacy at Eckerd's, you know. I thought that was good because we got money and pills, you know. So I liked that. And about that time, within a weekend after doing acid and stuff, you know, I eventually did meth and coke in one weekend. It was pretty much off to the races, you know, just lost, you know. I hated my life, I guess, you know, and I just wanted to feel numb all the time. And being young, I guess I was kind of curious. I remember being in AA. My mom had me, like, put in one of those, this place called Parkway Hospital at that time in Douglasville, and they had, like, a little floor there for people with, like, mental health and, like, drug and alcohol issues. And I remember being 18 years old in AA, you know, being in there, and I didn't want none of that. I did not want to be there because I'm like, I'm 18 years old. I'm not trying to get sober. I'm trying to live and have fun. You know, I thought that was all it was about, you know. So I was introduced to it at 18 years old, but nah, I wasn't there yet. And I was involved with that girl for about 3 years. And then she finally, you know, she's working and stealing. And I'm at home just drinking and doing drugs, you know, thinking this is the life. I'm not really doing anything. And, you know, she finally left, and that was tough at that point. You know, the way I got through that was a lot of booze, a lot of Xanax, a lot of weed, a lot of meth, stuff like that. You know, that's how I got through that, you know. Wanted to try the self-mutilation thing at that time, slicing myself, and that really wasn't my thing. I thought I'd give it a shot, you know. I was about 22 or so, I decided I wanted to go back to school or whatever, so I did get my GED and went to computer school for about 4 or 5 months, and I didn't stick with that because I already had a job. Basically, it was getting high and drunk, you know. That's all I really wanted to do. I didn't have time for school. I didn't have time to do nothing like that, you know. So I just kind of moseyed around, lost, you know, again, working here and there, doing like house painting and stuff like that, you know. Around that time, before I got my GED, I got my first DUI. I'd had a couple arrests, you know, 18, possession of weed, you know, stuff like that, leaving the scene of an accident, a couple of those. But I got a DUI. I 97, I turned 21 that December, 96, and went to a strip club. I think it was like my second time. Got loaded, drunk, you know, having a good old time. And, you know, got arrested. I was driving the wrong side down the expressway, you know. I thought I was on Jimmy Carter, and I was on 85. You know, I had no idea what was going on. And luckily, I didn't cause a wreck. I didn't hurt nobody. You know, I believe God was with me that night, you know. But I did get arrested. And, you know, in 97, I went to court. It was like, you're probation, you know, whatever. Just get out of here. It's not like that now, I know. You know, they don't play around with DUIs, but that's how it was in 97. You know, and during those years, I was always drinking and I was always smoking weed, you know, and I would mess around with different powder stuff, you know, and stuff like that and do all that. But the base was always drinking and smoking pot, basically. I was always doing that, you know, but I'd venture out a little bit. And I had my first, like around 98, I guess it was, not long after that, I was suicidal, and I went in a garage, and I found a rope, and I don't know how to do an official noose or nothing, you know, but so I tied a knot the best I could and everything, and hung it from a beam, you know, and stood up and kicked the chair out. It was hanging there, you know, and that was a scary thing, but I don't know how, but I somehow got out of it, you know, and that scared me, you know, that I kind of came that close to it. And that's how miserable I was, you know. I was really, really depressed, you know. I suffered from depression as well, and I never would take medicine, you know. I never would do the things they told me to do. I thought I knew better. I'll take care of this problem myself, and I see how that turned out, you know. So let's see, where am I at? I got another DUI about 2002, 2004. I'm just trying to get to the main parts here. It was like another suicide attempt by that point. I just took like 100 pills of stuff, just different random stuff, you know, and drank and just passed out. And my family found me, and they, you know, called the paramedics. They took me to the hospital, and I was there for a few days. They pump your stomach or whatever. I don't really remember what all was happening there. But then they sent me to the CAB Crisis Center, and, you know, they had AA meetings there, and I'm telling what happened. I'm thinking, I'm serious. I want to get clean now. You know, I'm reading the Bible. I'm doing all that stuff. And I was there maybe 10 days, 2 weeks at the most. You know, and then the minute they say, okay, you're going home today, I was like, all right, I'm getting drunk tonight. I'm going to get loaded. You know, it amazes me now when I look back at it how quick it was just like that. You know, that as soon as I knew I was going home, all those other plans were done, you know. Let's see. During this time, I was doing more coke. You know, I got into like the drinking cough syrup thing. I was real into that for a while, like the Robitussin and Vicks 44. You know, I call it robo tripping and stuff. You know, I just trip out on that stuff. You know, taking a lot of ephedrine at that point, like massive amounts. I'm surprised I'm alive now. Really am, like 25 at a time and stuff. You know, could have had a heart attack, but. You know, another example of like how bad addict, alcoholic I know I am is I can remember, you know, I'd walk into, like, across Campbell Park is Edgewood, and I think they've cleaned that up now, but it used to kind of be the hood, you know, it was hood enough for me. But I'd go there, you know, I mean, it was more hood than Campbell Park was, to put it that way. You know, across that track, and that's where I bought my dope, you know, and I'd go, you know, a white boy going down there at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'm wondering why I'm getting robbed, you know. You know, but I got robbed a few times, and then one time, you know, this guy's following me out or something. It's like turning daylight, and I just bought a bag of coke, and I can't remember exactly how it happened, but he like grabbed my jacket, you know, and he's like grabbing that, and he takes my jacket and everything, and I just run back home, you know, and I'm thinking, I didn't care about him. I had my wallet and everything. I didn't care about my jacket, my wallet being gone. All I cared about was he got my drugs, man. He got my stuff, man. And what I remember is I got home and I was wearing jogging pants and I felt something down there and, you know, I reached down like down by my ankle with the elastic, whatever it is. And that bag of coke was in there. So what I realized was somehow in that struggle subconsciously, I don't really know, I managed to get that dope away from him. You know, so I was happy. I'd get another jacket. I didn't get another wallet. I didn't get another ID. It didn't really matter. I had what I wanted. And, you know, and I got off on that, too. You know, they talk about the lifestyle of all that. You know, I really did. I enjoyed the rush of walking over there scoring and walking home and hoping I'm going to get home without getting arrested, that kind of stuff. You know, it wasn't just the drugs. It was the whole thing was like an adrenaline rush for me or something, you know. So eventually I started working with a team at Grady. They're called like the ACT team, Excel team or something at the time. They work with people with mental health and addiction. They got me a little apartment, a little efficiency at little Metropolitan. I was Parkway. I lived there for about 3.5 years. You know, the deal is be doing something with your life, be trying to get clean. I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm doing that. You know, I wasn't doing that. I just wanted a free place to live. It was getting loaded. I was breaking into people's houses there, you know. Their apartment, stealing from them, you know. I mean, you know, back up when I lived Campbell Park in those years, I ripped off all my neighbors, you know, people that had been like family, neighbors that lived next door, they're practically family. You know, I ruined that relationship with my family and their family because of me, you know, and that hurts now. But, you know, I made the amends for that, you know, and dealt with that. But I stole from everybody, you know, a lot of shoplifting arrests, shoplift beer and cough syrup, and just every time I got arrested, besides being 14 years old, it was revolved around my alcoholism and drug addiction one way or another. If it was DUI, if it was disorderly conduct, if it was stealing, everything, you know, it was all possession. I remember thinking back then, you know, if I could get clean, I'd probably quit going to jail, you know. Probably wouldn't be getting in all this trouble, you know, but that wasn't enough to stop me, you know. I didn't really know there was another way, really, or I didn't believe I could do it, you know. So I'm living there, ripping people off, you know, drinking, using, all that crap, in and out of Georgia Regional, in and out of places like Cab Chrysler. There was a couple few years there where I do these fake suicide attempts or whatever and end up at Georgia Regional. They knew me by first name. I got to be a regular there. It was sad, you know. They're like, what are you doing here again, you know? You know what's up, you know. And I just keep going back to the same thing. You know, I go to jail about once a year doing something, maybe twice a year. Maybe I go 2 years without going to jail, but I'd always eventually end up in jail again. Well, eventually about that time, it's like 2010, you know, my grandmother passes away, and she was the closest thing. As far as like a family member, she was like the one family member that was like a rock. You know, she was always there. You know, she was the one person I could always depend on, and she passed away, and that hurt. But I'm so numb on pain pills at this point and stuff, you know, that I was high at her funeral, you know, on pain pills. So I didn't really deal with it like I should have, like a healthy, mature person would, I guess. And I'd kind of, at this point also, like back up a little bit, I guess it was like 2005, 2006. I got mad at somebody and I punched the door, you know, and I went to the hospital and they gave me painkillers. So I was like, okay. So, and I literally did this for like a few days. I probably did it a few times after that. I went to each hospital. And I just keep banging my hand and punching it, beating it. You know, I'd be waiting to see the doctor. You know, I'd go in the bathroom, just be punching my hand, just making it worse and breaking it. And it's all bruised. It's already broke, you know. It's all bruised and messed up. But I'm just thinking, I'm going to get stronger drugs, you know, more, the worse this is, you know. And I kept doing that and doing that. And that kind of leads up to about a few years later is, like I said, the ephedrine, I don't know if people really know what that is, but it's like what they put in meth, you know, like the white crosses, those things. Like I said, I was real into those. And I went to the store one time. They didn't have them, so I was like, well, I'll get this bottle of Notos and, you know, eat all these. And I did, and I got real sick to my stomach. You know, I didn't really know it was. I didn't realize, I guess, that it was that was doing it at that point, because it took about 24 hours. And it felt like a knife was being turned in my stomach or something. So I go to the hospital, and they shoot me up with morphine. And I never had that before, and they gave me a prescription for pain pills, you know, and I was like, okay, so this is what it's going to be. Because I really enjoyed that, and this is where my pain, what really did me was the pain pills towards the end. That's what really got me at that last part. And I went to every hospital, Metro Atlanta, constantly for a few years, you know, to the point where, you know, they wouldn't refuse to see me at the hospitals, but I was in the computer. It's like, nah, don't give him no narcotics, you know. They kind of caught on to me. You know, but I still would try, and I'd go, and then when they'd say, we're not giving you none, I'd rip the IV out of my arm and walk out. You know, blood spewing on the floor and stuff sometimes, you know. But, so I did that, and eventually, you know, I'm still drinking, still doing any drug I can get my hands on. And I am living out there in Metropolitan. You know, I got involved with this woman. She was, like, much older than me, and it just kind of happened. We were, like, using buddies, and it turned into something else. And then we split up, and then I'm getting, this is getting towards the end, you know, getting real, real bad with the drugs. And I even start huffing gas a lot at this point when I don't have anything else. And I got evicted from that apartment. And I moved in with my mom temporarily. You know, she stayed there for about a month, 6 weeks, and she couldn't put up with my crap, basically. She couldn't deal with it, you know. because I'm at this point I'm physically addicted to pain pills and opiates, that I never went through the physical addiction like that before. And so I'm like in pain, you know, mentally and physically and all that, you know, sweating, and then you're cold, and then you sweat, and you're cold, you know, and whoever's familiar with that, you know what I'm talking about. And that was painful. So, you know, and I kind of try on my own to stop for a few days. But, you know, after 2 or 3 days of going through that, I'm like, just give me the drugs back, man. I can't do this. You know, it's too hard. Or it felt too hard at the time, you know. But I'm staying there. She finally calls, you know, the police. And, you know, I hadn't really broken the law and done anything, you know. But they say, well, you can't stay here, you know. So I pack up my stuff and I walk to my aunt's house, maybe a mile away. And this was May 24th, 2011. I'd managed to be sober for a couple of days there. And that's probably one reason I was in, being the way I was acting. I was like hurting. I need drugs, you know. And I walked there and, you know, my mom would put up with a lot of crap, you know. And when she puts me out, I walked to my aunt's and I realized I'd kind of talked her into letting me stay there, sort of. She wasn't like sold on the idea, obviously, you know. But I'm thinking this ain't going to end well right here, because I'll mess up one time and she'll put me out and I won't have anywhere to live at this point. You know, nowhere to stay after this. And so I call, you know, the crisis center. I tell them I got a drug problem. They're kind of like, well, that's not really enough to get in here and stuff at first, you know. It wasn't easy for me to get into a place like that. It really wasn't. I tried, like, calling some treatment centers. I was toying with the idea by this point before that. You know, I knew that was a big problem going on. I wasn't 100% on it, though, you know, but I finally told him, look, I'm going to kill myself, too. You know, I'm going to jump in front of a bus or something. And I was like, oh, you can come on in now, you know. So I was suicidal, but I learned from my clinician, like, when I went to treatment, she was like, I think you're suicidal. You just don't have the, you know, like, you don't have the guts to really do it, you know. But I was miserable at that point, you know. Like, I remember, you know, before all that happened, I can remember it was a day when I didn't have any alcohol or any drugs. I would just like lay in the bed and I wouldn't sleep, but I just lay there. I didn't want to watch TV. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to do, I just laid there and I was just in this like misery. This is pain. It's like this depression, you know. It was like something I don't ever want to feel again. You know, that's what it was like when I didn't have anything. I just laid there and I was suicidal, but too chicken to kill myself, and didn't want to live or didn't know how to live, and just like mentally, spiritually, emotionally, physically, you know, sick. And that's what I was. But I finally got into a crisis center, and they gave me, you know, like medicine, deal with the withdrawals for 5-7 days or something. And that helped. It wasn't as hard, it seemed like, when I was there anyway, to get off, to get through the withdrawals, and it seemed like it was at home. I stayed there for about a month or so. They had AA meetings there, and, you know, at that point I was willing, you know. I had willingness in the beginning. I don't, you know, I guess I was, at that point I was thinking, I don't really know if I'm going to stay sober. I don't really know what's going to happen, but, you know, what have I got to lose, you know. And I tried to get it, you know, and I was talking to a lot of guys. There was people in the Christ Center that have been back and forth through treatment centers and stuff like that. So I'm asking, you know, where should I go, man? What's a good place to go? And everybody said, St. Jude. Go to St. Jude. That's the best place you can go. So I tried to get in there first. It was like, we don't have a bed. I'm sure you guys heard that too, right? So I go to Salvation Army. But they turned me away because my ID had expired in like 5 years prior to that. You know, I didn't find it necessary to get a new ID. Sucked was trying to go buy beer when you're like 30-something years old. And they're like, no, we can't sell it to you. And it's like, damn it, don't you understand? I'm way past the age limit. But they're like, well, your ID's expired. Well, that sucked. But finally, I do get into St. Jude's. And, you know, I think when everybody was talking about how great it was, like, this place rules, that's where you want to go, blah, 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 you know. And I go in there, and it's like this old building on Renaissance Parkway in the hood. And I walk in there, and I guess I'm thinking it's going to be like when them Lindsay Lohan kind of rehabs or something, you know. Like, when's my massage, you know. But That's not how it was. So I'm looking around kind of thinking, like, oh, man, what is this? You know, am I going to be able to do this? I don't know. I don't know if I can do this, you know. And every few weeks there, it was really tough, you know. I didn't really, you know, again, it was kind of like being in school where I kind of didn't feel like I fit in or something. I don't know. I was, you know, I was, like I said, I was an isolator for so long. I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to open up and talk about me and my feelings and stuff. I never dealt with feelings, ever. So the first thing that helped me when I was there was the day group. You know, they have day group. You go to day group for like 2 months, and they have meetings like every night and stuff. And the first place I started to kind of talk and open up was in day group because it was smaller. It was a little more intimate. There's like 8-10 people at the most or something, at least when I was there. So I started kind of slowly talking and opening up, you know. And then I started slowly talking and opening up in the meeting, in the meetings, the AA meetings and NA meetings, stuff like that. And that was helping. You know, my clinician told me right off the bat, get a home group here, you know. And then you can get a home group wherever you want to, but get one here for now. So I joined the Renaissance group there, and I'm still a member of that group. I still do service for that group. I did that. You know, I got a sponsor. I bounced around from several sponsors when I first got there because I'm thinking I'm looking for the perfect sponsor, the perfect person, you know. Alcoholics and addicts, probably nobody perfect, you know. But I didn't really know what I was looking for. You know, I'd never done it before. I'd never been to treatment before. Never. So I asked this one guy to be my sponsor, and he dragged my feet, or dragged his feet, whatever the proper way of saying that is, for so long. He let me down when he was supposed to go over my step work. I finally had to fire him. And I went to Triangle one night. And it was just kind of like happened the way it happened, you know. There was a guy there, and he shared, and I liked what he shared. And, you know, I asked him after the meeting, you know, will you be my sponsor? I need a new sponsor. I need somebody to take me through the steps. I knew that's what I needed was the steps. And he said, yeah. He said, call me tomorrow, and we'll figure, you know, we'll go from there. So I called him the next day. And, you know, right off the bat, he had me working steps. He had me right into it, and that's what I was looking for. That guy, he passed away a week ago. He had been my sponsor until a couple months ago. And he relapsed, and I knew that. But, you know, he passed away. I just found that out last week. But he had me work through the steps, and he didn't mess around about that. And I was real grateful for that. I stayed at St. Jude's for about 9 months. I went back and forth with the housing. I had bad luck with the housing. They have transition housing, you know. I was supposed to go here, then I was denied. I was supposed to go there, I was denied. So I'm hanging there for, you know, it's a 6-month program. They're 9 months. Wonder where I'm going to go. And so I finally get into these apartments they had at that point in Decatur. And then I was there about 5 months. They closed those down. I get into this house, this right around the corner from my job. That was real sweet. That was like, I was there 7 months, and then they closed that down. Made us all move out of there into their only house they had left at that point. And, you know, it had been almost 2 years since I'd been sober at that point. I was tired of packing up and moving. And I was kind of thinking, look, I just want to live somewhere where as long as I pay my rent, I got to worry about leaving, you know. So I got an apartment with some guys that I was in treatment with. And we shared that apartment for about a year, and that was really great. You know, it's awesome living with a couple guys that are also sober because we never had a problem between us. And, you know, if we were all drinking and using, that probably would not be the case, you know. So that worked out really well. You know, I just continued to work the steps, going to meetings, that kind of thing. And, now, I eventually moved out of there, and then I had to move back home for a minute, and recently got an apartment with another good friend of mine in recovery, and that's going well. You know, they talk about, like, there's 5 or 6 things to do to stay sober, you know, and basically, I can just talk about what I do, I guess. Is, you know, I pray in the morning, and ask God, I get on my knees, I pray, and ask God to keep me sober. I read my meditations, I pray more. You know, I talk with another alcoholic or addict or communicate somehow every day. You know, I go to as many meetings as I can, the literature, the steps, the service, you know, those things. And then pray at night and say thanks. Thank you, God, for keeping me sober, you know, today. And that's the only reason I've made it. You know, it's the same stuff they taught me in treatment. It's the same thing they talk about in these rooms and in the program. You know, it's really, that's the only difference between somebody that makes it and doesn't make it, I believe. Just somebody that keeps doing the things. Because there are a lot of people, I see a lot of people do it for a minute. They do good in treatment, and then once they leave treatment, that's it. You know, I see that way too often. I'm still real involved in the treatment center I go to. But, you know, I talk to a lot of guys when I go there. A lot of people that are early, and they always ask me, I hear it a lot from people, and they're like, you know, is it better now? Is life better than it was? And I'm like, there's no comparison. For me, there's no comparison. You know, I learned a lot in treatment. I learned how to pay my bills or to pay rent, which I've never done. I learned how to shower every day. I learned how to brush my teeth every day. I learned how to be a man, be responsible, that kind of stuff. And I didn't, you know, when I got there, I was like a 35-year-old, 14-year-old boy. That's basically what I was, because that's where I'd left off at, about 14, 15 years old. And I acted out a lot in treatment. I was an angry guy. I was mad about the world. You know, I know now I was really mad at myself is what it was. I was mad at the predicament I'd let my life come to. And it was my fault. All that was my fault, you know. What I found through working through the steps and doing all that is there's a lot of stuff that I'm not proud of that I did, but I'm able to live with it today because it happened. I've done something about it. I'm trying to make amends by the way I live today and to those people, my family, the ones that I hurt. And so I can live with it today. I can deal with it because that's the thing for me, I guess, is you know, I did something about it, I'm doing something about it, and I didn't do it by myself either. You know, not at all. You know, when I got to treatment, my higher power was treatment. That was basically my higher power in the beginning. Then it became the program, and then it became a God of my understanding. And as long as it's not me is what I always heard, you know. I just know that my life was horrible before I got here. I was depressed. I was miserable. I hated living. I hated being alive. Because it hurt. You know, being sober hurt for me. I don't know how it is for other people, but it was painful for me. I used to numb myself. Constantly. You know, like, I didn't just use when I was upset or when I was happy to celebrate. I just used and drank because I didn't want to feel sober. Because I did a lot of terrible things. And then the only way to deal with that is to get loaded again. Because I can't deal with that. And then I do another terrible thing, and I get loaded to deal with that. This is how it was for me, you know. But, you know, I'll say to anybody that's new, and I've only been in the program a few years, you know. But there's somebody that's in treatment or new or doesn't really know if it works or nothing. I can only give my experience is that it does work. And I wouldn't trade this for nothing. I would, and, you know, I heard a wise person say before that the miracle is not really that I don't use or drink no more. The miracle is that I don't want to. And I have no desire today to drink or use. And I'm not really exactly sure when that left. Like the urge and that compulsion left me pretty early. What I mean was when I was in treatment, you know, like pretty much that just urge, like, I got to go use right now, you know, that started to leave right then. There's still some thoughts kicking around at that point, like you're trying to, how can I sneak this a little bit, maybe, you know, something like that going on. But now it's like, I don't want to drink or use today. And even if I did, I wouldn't want to risk it because I don't want to throw this away. And I feel like this was a gift from God, my higher power. And I feel like if I was to use or drink, for one, it'd be like slapping him in the face or spitting in his face. That maybe he saved my life, and it's like, look, this is your last chance, buddy. That's how I look at it. You know, I could be wrong, but I don't want to take that risk, you know, that maybe if I go back out, I won't make it back. And I've seen that a lot of people that relapse, and then they just die right off the bat as soon as they relapse. A lot of guys I see that are in the treatment center that I was at, they leave or something happens, and a month later you hear they're dead, found dead. And that's scary to me. And that's a miracle in itself for me today is I don't want to be dead today. I want to live. You know, life is tough sometimes. You know, I've lost some people in recovery. The person I lost, you know, a week ago was the closest person I've lost in recovery. And that hurts. But I'm trying to look at it the right way of like being grateful for the time I had with him, for the stuff that he taught me, the stuff that he told me, this stuff. Especially now, it's being magnified even more in my head. I hear a lot of them, stuff he told me. Stuff I remembered and knew about, but it's just sometimes it gets echoed a little more. This past week, you know, I just keep thinking about all the stuff he taught me. And regardless what, how it ended for him, he still taught me a lot of good things that have kept me sober for a while. So I'm grateful for that. But it does suck. I'm not going to lie. I don't really know what else to say. I just know that this is the greatest gift I've ever received. You know, I can remember judges and probation officers and psychiatrists and people telling me you need to go to treatment a long time ago. Like, I'm like, no, I ain't going nowhere for 6 months. I ain't doing nothing like that. Blah, 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 blah. No. Turns out they were right and I was wrong. That this was the greatest gift that I've ever received. And I don't deserve it either. I don't think I deserve it. But I'm grateful that I got it, you know. And the only thing I can do is try to help somebody else with it and try to give it away. And I try to do that. I'm a sponsor now. I try to do well at that. I haven't really had a whole lot of super good luck at that so far. But I'm just going to keep trying and hopefully it'll work out. You know? I guess that's my time here. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for being here. Can't do this without you.
Thank you, Mike, for sharing your story with us. I'm sure your sponsor would be real proud of you. And with that, I believe I'm going to invite Hunter up here to pass out the
Hey, Hunter. I'm just going to go through them once. Does anybody need a white chip? Come on.
My sleep, it'll never leave. again.